Hi, everybody. Welcome to the April, is this April?
Yes.
Meeting?
Amazing, but true.
I know, it's like so fast. Welcome to the April AES meeting. I'd like to welcome you all here and thank you for coming. I just want to start off by thanking the Art Institute of Seattle for having us. And I want to start off thanking Skylar and Atticus for hosting us and being a huge help. And before we get going, passing the mic around, I just want to ask if you guys had anything you wanted to say or any announcements.
Hi, guys. So my name is Skylar Bendel, and this is Atticus, and we run the audio club here on campus. And I just wanted to thank you guys so much for coming here. And thank Dan for setting this up. We're really honored to have you guys here. So, thank you.
Do you have a student section?
We do. We have a student section. We're working on building that up. Hopefully going to get more involved and get more in the community over time. So, look for us. Thanks.
Thank you. So, first I want to start with a few announcements. We have elections coming up. The next meeting is going to be next month. And that's where we take the names to build the slate. And then, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this. I think I got it right. And then the following meeting, which is in June, is when we take actually hold the election. So if you're interested in running for a committee or one of the offices, or if you know someone you'd like to nominate, next month's meeting would be the meeting to do that. Speaking of next month's meeting, we're still putting the final touches on the meeting. But I'd like to just throw out a teaser. It's going to be at Microsoft Research, and one of the audio researchers there, who's a member of our committee, is putting on a presentation. And don't know the details, but I know that he wanted to wait until the HoloLens shipped before he held the talk. So I think it's going to be very interesting. I don't want to say any more than that because I'm light on the details. But check our website for updates. I think that's going to be a great meeting. Okay, without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to you, JC.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Dan, for inviting me. Thank you, Audio Institute, Audio Club, for having us. I'm John Coulter. I'm an AV system technician at Seattle Center at McCaw Hall. I've been at Seattle Center almost 20 years, and before that I did national tours, regional and repertory theater, opera and ballet, and I was in school before that. After we opened McCaw Hall, we started doing a lot of big shows that had more and more wireless microphones, wireless intercoms, and in-ear monitor systems. And with the bandwidth shrinking and the demand growing, I eventually got tapped to become the radio frequency coordinator for Seattle Center. So it's not something that I've gone to school for. It's just something that I've sort of cribbed for on the side of doing my regular day job. So frequency coordination is what we're here to talk about tonight. How to manage your frequencies for the shows that you do, how to scan your RF environment and analyze the available bandwidth, and how to cope with the inevitable competition. So if you have any questions, please just get up on a microphone and say, hey, JC, and stop me and ask me your question. I don't want to have to wait. I'm going to skip over a whole lot of topics. And so I'd rather just stop and deal with a question as soon as it comes up. I'm more comfortable that way. Just say, hey, JC, and ask me your question. And if any of the old timers catch me in a factual error or a conceptual misconception, just let me know and we can all learn something. Before I get started, I'm going to make all these slides available afterwards, so don't worry about taking any notes or anything like that. You can get it all on the website, and you can watch Dan's excellent video. Before I get started, I want to give some credit to James Stoffo, the founder of Professional Wireless Systems, Inc., and also the author of the frequency coordinating software that I'm going to demo in the second half. He came to Seattle last year and gave a very excellent presentation on this topic at Seattle Center, and I asked him to borrow his slide deck, and he graciously allowed me to do that. So a lot of this material belongs to James, and thanks to him. That's James Stoffo at the Super Bowl. He also does the Academy Awards and a lot of really other big shows all year long, and he's a great guy. So let's start with the elephant in the room, the FCC auction of the 600 now megahertz spectrum that we're all used to playing in with our wireless microphones. Who still watches TV over the air? Who's got rabbit ears on their TV? Dan and a whole bunch of other people. Wow, I was not expecting that response. You guys are in a definite minority, and that's what this is really all about, is that broadcast television used to be the dominant and considered the best use of the premium UHF frequencies, and now it's just not the case. The competition is great for these premium frequencies that can cover a lot of territory and that can punch through buildings. These are really great frequencies to have, and we're about to lose the battle on another chunk of them. Most of the radio spectrum that we use for wireless mics and other pro audio stuff is the so-called white space between the UHF television channels, between 470 megahertz and 700 megahertz. The FCC is currently holding its second big spectrum auctions, where TV stations may, but are not required to, offer up their 6 megahertz over-the-air channel licenses to be bid on and purchased by the big telecoms for mobile phone and data use, very similar to what happened in 2008, but with some significant differences this time, and I'll talk about how this auction is going to work. It's already underway, and we don't know how it's going yet. It's early days. There's been a lot of backstage shenanigans before and during this auction where holders of these television station licenses, which are often not the stations themselves, have been buying and selling these licenses as a commodity in preparation for this auction, hoping to turn a big buck. You've got private equity, you've got hedge funds, you've got big nonprofits, all trying to position themselves to turn a fast buck on this auction. And the FCC itself stands to make tens of billions of dollars in profit on the process. So this is a really big deal. I want to do a little review of the history of these auctions and where we've been with UHF bandwidth over the past 20 years. Some of these slides have some really fine content, and if anybody wants to move up, I don't mind, just move on up. The projector's doing the best it can. So 20 years ago, we had some analog UHF television stations and a whole lot of white space in between them. Life was good. In 1996, I took out a national tour of a Broadway musical. I had 12 brand new Sony Frequency Agile UHF microphone sets. They were awesome. I went from coast to coast and never refrequencied them once. You try that today, you won't get out of town. Then we entered a transition period where digital TV started to come online, and we had our analog stations and we had our digital stations, and some of them were the same stations. And it kind of complicated things for a while, and the white space got a little skinnier. And so some of us bought new equipment and some of us didn't, and we kind of got by, but we were nervous because it was like, what's going on here? We're all moving to digital, but we're not there yet. And so these TV stations are taking up more room than they used to. And then came 2008 with the big 700 megahertz auction. Everybody went digital, and they all had to crown down between 470 and 700, and everything above 700 became off limits, and we got the big order from the FCC that said, get out of the pool. That's not what's happening this time. What's happening this time is that the FCC says, hey, TV stations, we want your bandwidth. We want you to consider what your little chunk of bandwidth is worth, put a price tag up on it, throw it up on the big board. If somebody wants your license that bad, they'll pay you your top dollar. If somebody doesn't want it that bad, they can pass. You'll get another chance to lower your price and see if anybody will buy it at that. I heard a rumor, I don't know if this is true, that CBS station in New York City posted their 1 6 megahertz chunk on the big board at $900 million. That's one market, one TV station. The auction has begun. It is not public. We don't know where we're at. We don't know if bids have been made on the first round. We don't know if any stations have been sold. We're waiting to find out.
Casey?
Yes.
No,
they are not. They are invited to auction their license. What may happen is that the small stations go first because they've been being commodified. I've been watching all the low-power stations in our market for 10 years, and they pop up and they disappear, and sometimes they're on and sometimes they're off, and sometimes it's Christian broadcasting, and sometimes it's Spanish, and sometimes it's home shopping, and sometimes it's a test pattern. And then there's some days that these stations just disappear and don't come back.
but I'm working around them anyway, because if I don't know come show day if that's a TV station or not, I can't use that bandwidth. And I'm going to show you some more about that a little bit later. So in the 700 megahertz auction, AT&T and Verizon spent a lot of money, and they did very well for themselves. And anybody who has a late model AT&T or Verizon phone with 4G LTE, you are enjoying the benefits of this spectrum auction right here that caused a lot of us to have to sell a lot of microphones. That's good for everybody. It's not so good for us. So AT&T and Verizon were the big players the last time around. They are on the periphery this time around because they're sitting pretty. They won the game last time. And there's only certain markets where they're going to go, oh, maybe I just want that one. But they're not the big players. The big players this time around are T-Mobile, because they didn't win big last time, and they want to be a top player. Comcast wants to get into the cell phone game big time, and they want to get into broadband over the air. There are a lot of other no-name players that we don't really know who they are and what their agenda is, except that they're buying and selling commodities. This is like Wall Street right now. Private equity, some big nonprofits. A lot of people that we don't know who they are could be bidding big money for some of these things. So this is a theoretical. We don't know where this is going, but we think that something like this is what's going to happen. We have a promise from the FCC this time. This is one of the biggest differences from the last time around. We have a promise from the FCC that every major market will have at least two channels that are left open for pro audio use. Right now, I can look up and see that there are two of them that are available right now. We don't know if they're going to change. Some of you may be operating in those channels right now. You may be operating in them and you don't know them. You may be operating in some of these other spaces and don't know it. But there are naturally occurring white spaces between some of these TV channels for electronic reasons. Some of those may survive, or technology may make it possible for them to crowd in further than we hope they do. There are also, there's new technology that has come out called TV white space devices. This is basically allowing for over-the-air data distribution over limited geographical networks. For example, Microsoft sponsored a TV white space device network at Seattle Center that covers the area of the International Fountain. And so they put up a bunch of wireless access points, and those backhaul their data to the backbone over UHF transmitters that use a TV station's bandwidth. So in addition to having TV stations, naturally occurring white space, space that's been carved out for our use, there's also these other things that FCC has said, well, you can operate this stuff if you don't step on anybody's toes. These TV white space devices, these Wi-Fi things, they use a 6 megahertz chunk. They often use several. The demo project at Seattle Center wanted to use 5 TV stations worth of bandwidth for 10 megabits of data for cell phone people to use. It was not a big success. The system is still operating. But there was a lot of push and pull. And when they rolled this thing out and added 5 TV stations to my roster of places that I couldn't play, we sat down at the table and we kind of took them to task. And I'll tell the end of that story a little bit later. So here's the worst case scenario. Here's what we have now on the top. We have a couple of channels that FCC says, yeah, you can play there. Big telecoms are going to buy big chunks. It's possible they could buy the whole thing. I don't think they're going to buy the whole thing, and Staffa doesn't think they're going to buy the whole thing. We think it's going to be kind of a patchwork. The bigger a market you're in, the more likely it is that you're going to lose more, if not all, of what you've been used to playing with in the 600s, but I don't think that we're going to lose it all. However, if we do lose it all, FCC still says that we're going to get a couple of channels that are reserved for our use, for unlicensed wireless microphone use. There are also ways, if you have the money, if you can adopt some new technologies, if you can get your FCC license together, there are some places you can play in between some of these telco bands. This is called the duplex gap. It appears between downlink and uplink traffic of cell phones and other data. There are certain devices that will be able to play in here. There's part of that that's going to be for licensed users only. There's part of it that's going to be shared with TV white space devices, maybe, if they succeed. There's also a guard band between telecom and television. We might be able to operate in there. So there's a lot of theoretical stuff that sort of all adds up to don't panic yet.
They're not allowing you above Channel 51?
One moment, please. That's where James stopped on his graph. Channel 51, anything above Channel 51 is completely off limits and has been since 2010. That's your 700 megahertz band. That's wall-to-wall telco. We're not ever going to play there again. What we're talking about now is the 600 megahertz band, which has been very good to us, and we're really not sure at this point where it's going to go. So that last slide is the worst-case scenario, and we just have to wait and see. So if you're curious, this is a Google search string that I really like. Hit it weekly, monthly, quarterly. You're going to get a lot of returns right now on the business pages. You're going to see CNBC and the Wall Street Journal writing about this stuff because it's a commodities market, and there's a lot of money to be made. So I'm actually getting more useful information from the business pages right now than I'm getting from pro audio sources. Once the FCC gives us the final rule, we will have over 3 years of a transition period before they lock it in. So it's more time than we had last time, and they have made certain guarantees that there will be some white space preserved within that band. So we just have to wait and see. In the meantime, I want to talk about how the FCC wants you to behave and how everybody else does it. What the FCC would really like for us all to do is get a Part 74 license. However, you have to be a big player to get a Part 74 license. So when Seattle Center sat down at the table with Microsoft's contractors over the TV white space devices, they said, well, you don't have a license, neener neeners. And we said, well, you don't either. And so then we looked this up. And basically, if you have control, if you have control of 50 or more frequencies, you may apply for a Part 74 license. Well, we scraped our inventory, and we came up with 50 units. We didn't even have to share with the theaters, which is what we thought we were going to have to do, is make a coalition with all the theaters. But we came up with, because there's 36 frequencies of wireless intercom at McCaw Hall alone, we came up with 50 pretty easy. And we hired a contractor to help us navigate the red tape, and we got ourselves a Part 74 license. What that allows us to do is reserve our frequencies on a per-event basis. That allows us to shut down the TV white space devices on a per-day, per-event basis based on our reservations. So maybe they don't have to shut down all five of their channels. Maybe we'll take three of them. But because we now have a license, we have the ability to shut them down. The other thing that a Part 74 license allows you to do is operate pro audio equipment in some very low frequency VHF bandwidth. Very interesting. I think within a couple of years, we're going to start seeing digital VHF low frequency microphones and intercoms come on the market. I know for a fact that there are a couple of companies working on this. There are some guys that put a company together called Radioactive Designs. They've got a very interesting wireless intercom product that's coming out that works in duplex. It's part VHF. The main high-power transmit for that system is in the VHF band. It's digital. The antennas are still very long, but because they're transmit antennas, they're fixed. So if there's a pool cue in the corner of the stairway, that's no big deal. The belt packs return on UHF, tight band, digital, and they're very, very efficient with their bandwidth. If you have a Part 74 license, you may also operate at higher power levels, including 250 milliwatts in the UHF band, which is previously unheard of and perhaps not wise. And when we get into intermodulation and frequency coordination, I'll tell you why you probably don't want to operate at 250 milliwatts indoors. So the FCC would like for us all to be big players. They'd all like us to be Carlson Audio in Seattle Center and get a Part 74 license. If you have 8 units to your name, you're not going to do that. What you're going to do is you're going to look up your location in one of several geolocation databases, which are all synchronized, and it doesn't matter which one you start with, and it all pulls and pushes information to and from the FCC. It shows you which channels are available for your use right now in your zip code. It allows you to register an event even if you're not licensed. You may apply to have your frequencies reserved for an event. They would like for you to do that 30 days in advance. So, you know, get working on your calendar right now for your wireless mics. They also may turn you down, because if somebody else with a Part 74 shows up and wants your bandwidth, they're going to get it.
Missy, I have a question.
Yes.
Sorry, Dan. The United Methodist Church in the Seattle-Tacoma area has 34 churches, and we're all using wireless mics, or most of us using wireless mics, probably all of us in the next 3 or 4 years. But it's over quite a wide range of zip codes. Would the Methodist Church in this area be looking at getting a Part 74 license or not?
I would encourage you to look into that. And if you contact any of the contractors that are brokering those license applications right now, I know that there are a couple of them locally, and Professional Wireless Systems also offers that service. They can tell you whether your equipment has to be co-located or not. I don't know the answer to that question. But I would encourage you to pursue it, because if you can get a Part 74, you're going to be ahead of the game. You still have to register your event on an event basis. Now, you can batch those. You can go and register like a month of Sundays if you want, if you have a license. So I would encourage you to look into that. But I don't know if your equipment has to be co-located or not. So this is how they would like for you to play. And whether you or not you want to play by the rules or not, and, you know, it's kind of, in fact, always been the Wild Wild West, and it's going to continue to be, but it's going to get tougher if you're going to freeboot this stuff. So these are some of the active databases. They all basically have the same data. Some of them have better user interface than others. I'm fond of Spectrum Bridge. But it doesn't really matter which one you use, because they are required by the FCC to push and pull all the same information, and they update every 20 minutes. So check out one of these databases. You can download my slides later. Ask one of the license assistance contractors for advice. And there's also a really great website called part74.com that might actually answer your question about the churches. So if I go to Spectrum Bridge and I put in the zip code at Seattle Center, it gives me a little map, and it tells me what's available in my neighborhood right now. And it's some very interesting things. So it tells me what the two FCC reserved white space channels are in my zip code. And right now it's 36 and 40. So I know that nothing but microphones and TV white space devices can be found in those channels right now. But then it also gives me a bunch of very interesting VHF bandwidth that I don't currently have any equipment to operate in, but it says it's wide open. And so that's something to watch. That's a space to watch. Digital equipment in the VHF band is going to make a comeback. We're already seeing equipment in higher frequencies, like 900 megahertz, 1.8. I'm not a big fan of this equipment, because most of it is packetizing the signal. Packetized audio is inherently asynchronous. You get latency, and you frequently get data compression that compromises your audio quality. So I'm not a big fan of microphones that use Wi-Fi, microphones that use telephone technology such as DECT, D-E-C-T, in the 900 megahertz band. These microphones are very cheap, they have low audio quality, and they have hideous latency. They're also not protected from interference from other Wi-Fi and DECT systems, like your cordless telephone in the kitchen. So back to Spectrum Bridge, there's some very juicy VHF bandwidth here. Keep your eye on that bandwidth and watch the magazines and stuff for equipment to start appearing within the next 2 years, I predict.
I got a note here saying that the FCC was talking before they started issuing the rules, they were going to open 3 and 4 and 14 through 20.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
VHF is all open, so they pull you up above.
Yes, so they are definitely opening up some VHF bandwidth, but I don't think anybody has saved their VHF microphones from the 80s if they had, they might be able to turn a buck, except they probably don't sound very good under 3 inches of dust. Dan?
I have.
Do you still have them? Awesome. Well, you might be able to turn a buck with those if you shine them up a little bit. So right now, in 98109, there's a lot of white space. And I've been cruising in it for years and, you know, soaking in it like Madge, but this stuff is going to go away. And so keep your eye on the databases. These databases are updated every 20 minutes. They're better than what you're going to find at, like, sure.com or, you know, some database that's not updated every 20 minutes. This is the place to be, Spectrum Bridge or any one of these other ones. Get familiar with one or more of these databases because things are going to start changing really fast.
JC, I have a question.
Chris.
So, actually, two questions. One, I see the channel number here, and is that the television channel?
That is the television channel.
And how many, if you take one of those channels, how many channels of audio can you get in that channel?
It kind of depends on the equipment that you're using. Typical wideband analog microphones like Shure UHFR, ULXP, you can get 10 or 12 in there if there's nobody else playing. You know, if you had one wide open to yourself, if you're in a pretty good shielded building and you're broadcasting at low power, yeah, you can get 10 or 12 per channel. I can currently get 50 or 60 into 10 or 11 channels, and I'm going to do a demo of that. Because the more you get, the fewer you can get in each channel. And there's some electronic reasons for that.
I see. And I'm just curious, this system that you're describing here, does it let you, like, go in the future and see if someone has reserved certain spaces?
Yes, it does. If there are existing reservations, these databases will show you those reservations. Uh-huh. Yes. This is the two-way. This is the forum for official frequency reservations. And so if you can make your requests through these portals, and you can see what other people have succeeded in reserving. So for the last 10 years, I've been tracking what my antennas at McCall Hall can actually see in the spectrum. And I update this spreadsheet every time I do a major show. Every time I see a low-power station that comes and goes, I make a note of it. And if it stays gone for long enough, I might delete it. But usually it's an additive process, and I want to know everybody who's working out there in this band. This section I have entitled, "What Can You Do Right Now While You're Waiting for the FCC to Tell You How Bad It's Going to Be?" And what you can do is get familiar with your RF environment. Because this is my building, but your building might be different. Your outdoor venue might be different. You've got to start scanning the spectrum and see what your equipment can see. And you want to use the antennas in your equipment to do those scans. In your venue, early and often, take notes, monitor the changes. This stuff is really important. I've been working on this spreadsheet for 10 years, and I still look at it at least once a month and look at actual scans and make sure that I'm on top of my background of television stations, where they are, what's my inventory, what's my permanent situation, what's my portable situation, and what are other venues in my neighborhood doing with all of this spectrum, so that when I start to do a coordination for a big show, I have a baseline. I know what the landscape looks like. Scanning hardware and software. Before I get to hardware and software, this is a scan that I ran outdoors at Seattle Center in 2014 when we were having a tussle with the white space guys. And I just want to kind of show you around this scan because there's a lot of features that are easily identifiable if you know what you're looking for. So I started this scan down below 470. This is 470 where our equipment begins and goes up. But right below 470, there's a really interesting area of activity. All these little spiky intermittent things are commercial two-way radios, walkie-talkies, stuff that you would rent from Day Wireless or Bear. They're everywhere. They're completely ubiquitous. and you will always see activity down here from 450 to 470 that is intermittent, powerful, and on the move. This is a scan that was done with Wind Radio. I'm going to talk about Wind Radio in a minute, but one reason that I really like this tool is that you get multiple traces. You get the red peaks are the maximum measurement for that frequency taken during that scanning period. The blues are the minimums at that frequency. The yellow trace is the current pass. It's the newest information. And the purple stuff down below is how much change has there been in it. So we got our two-way radios down here, 450 to 470. Then we start with TV channel 14. That's the beginning of the TV band of UHF. This is what a digital television station looks like at low power. This is what a digital television station looks like when it's right around the corner. This is a very powerful local DTV station. Back when TV was analog, we didn't have these big square corners at the top. They weren't using the entire 6 megahertz at full power. It was much more of a peak. There was less information in the signal. Now that we have digital substations, you have 14.1, 14.2, 14.3. They're all in that same chunk, and they're using it wall to wall. So they're much squarer on top than they used to be. This is a very, very typical DTV signature in your RF scan. So the first thing this scan shows me, starting at 470, is that I have a bunch of TV stations, and some of them are more powerful than others. Some are closer. So some have bigger transmitters, and some are just closer. This is both close and powerful. I have some other things here. I have these are microphones. This is what a typical wireless microphone looks like in a broadband scan. It's very narrow. It's very tight. And if you have coordinated it properly, its slope will go all the way to the noise floor with no appreciable amount of interference at the base of that slope. That's what we really want to see with microphones when we get a bunch of them, is we want to see a very steep slope that goes all the way to the noise floor. We have some other stuff. We have some spurious intermodulation products. We're going to talk about intermodulation later. These are danger points. They're not very powerful, but when they add up, they're a big pain in the butt. This is our TV white space device. Very low power, but it's taking up a full 6 megahertz bandwidth. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4. And that is either a faraway TV station or it's a TV white space device that's very close. But I think on this day, we were actually looking at 1, 2, 3, 4 TV white space devices. They were, in fact, interfering with some of our microphones that day. We were able to document that, and that was the beginning of our getting off our butts and getting to Part 74 at Seattle Center. So I do a lot of this. Every time I do a show with wireless mics, more than, I'd say, four, I roll this whole rig out, and I run these scans. And, yes, Dan.
Your comment about the white spaces device and getting off your butt to do something, are you going to talk about the process for either being shut down because you're interfering with somebody or somebody else shutting you down?
I'm actually not going to talk about that because I haven't experienced it.
Okay.
We tried to get out ahead of it, and we've been successful in dealing with our nearest white space competitor. And
because you know them and they're part of the Seattle Center, which is your deal, you're able to talk to them without going through the FCC?
Well, we do register our events with the FCC. That information shows up on the geolocation databases, and then we make a courtesy call to the contractor and say, we have a reservation on this date. Please review the database and modify your equipment accordingly.
So the courtesy call is the mechanism for notifying them if they're not paying attention.
And so far they've not caused us a lot of trouble because most of our events are indoors. It was more of a protective stance for us. So this is the radio scanner that I prefer. We did a lot of research back in 2010 when we had to throw away all of our 700 megahertz gear. We thought, okay, we got to get serious and study our environment. And this is the radio that we settled on. It costs anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500, depending on the feature set and the bandwidth that you want to work in. But it's about $1,000 to get into one of these, and the software is free. And it's Windows only, and it's a pretty good graphical interface. The one nice thing that when the radio system has that most of the other scanner systems don't have is an audio demodulator. So if you stop the scan on a particular channel that's generating analog audio, you can actually listen to what's on that channel. So it's a pretty feature-rich radio receiver that you can demodulate analog audio on. It's just a nice little added feature. I don't use it often, but it's nice to be able to sit on something and go, oh, yeah, that's audio. That's not data. That's not just spurious noise. That's not taxicabs. That's audio. Somebody's operating a microphone. Or it's an intermodulation product from something I'm doing incorrectly. So it's a nice little diagnostic tool. It's a pretty small box. I've got one sitting up here on the desktop right here. It's almost handheld, and I think it's a really good deal. It's one of the low-cost industry standards without having to go to a $10,000 Anritsu unit like the cell phone guys are using. The industry standard pro audio frequency coordination software is IAS, Intermodulation Analysis System, from Professional Wireless Systems, Inc. It's James Stoffo's company. He wrote this product. It's a very good product, and I use it all the time. It's cost $500 for a pro license. There is a demo version, and there's also sort of a limited version. But if you're going to be working with more than 30 channels ever, $500 to get the full license is a really good idea. And I'm going to demo this software after the break. If you have Shure equipment, if you have late model pro-level Shure equipment that is networkable, Wireless Workbench is free and fairly powerful software. It has a scanner built in that uses your microphone receivers and antennas as a scanner radio receiver. It has a graphical interface that's not as good as WinRadio, but it's perfectly serviceable. It has some nice features, and they've even started to add some competitors' make and model radio information into their coordination section. It's not a very good frequency coordinator, but it's free. So if you have Shure gear that is networkable, that's UHFR, ULXD, this is a fairly good product, and it's worth more than its cost of zero. There are a number of handheld scanners on the market. They're not as feature-rich as the PC-based scanners, but I have one of these tools, and it's not my go-to for wideband scanning, but it's a great little problem solver because you can zero right in on something. It's much faster than WinRadio, but it doesn't have the audio part. One thing that this unit is really good for, it's called the TTI scanner, and the company is called AIM TTI. They have their own website, and they're also sold through some big retailers like Newark. What does this thing cost? The TTI goes for about $1,200, or it did when we bought it in 2010. There are newer models. The original ones were built on a Palm Pilot hardware with sort of a case built around them and some extra buttons. They ran out of Palm Pilot, so this is new hardware, and it's probably better than it used to be and probably a little bit more expensive. The nice thing about this particular handheld is that you can put a directional antenna on it and go find a problem. If you're on a big show in a big venue or you're outdoors and you're like, what is that? It's kind of like an RF Fox and Hounds. So nice unit, but not my go-to wideband scanner. When Stoffo was here, he hipped us to a new product that I have not seen or held in my hand, but I would very much like to. It's called the RF Explorer. It starts at $129. It is a handheld wideband UHF scanner. They have versions that go up into the gigahertz. It's very small. It has very limited graphic interface. Less so than the TTI, but the price is right, and you can actually bundle it with some software that runs on Windows and Macintosh called ClearWaves. It's a great graphical interface for the scanner itself. It also does frequency coordination calculations, and the bundle of the RF Explorer plus the ClearWaves software package, $350. So Stoffo thinks this is pretty cool. I'm inclined to agree with him. I'd like to get one in my hands and really try it and see if the ClearWaves can really hold up to the really excellent feature set of IAS, which costs twice as much. So those are some tools you can think about using to get to know your RF environment, to start to analyze, see what's out there, determine the baseline for your venue and your neighborhood. Now, the nitty-gritty, coordinating frequencies for your event. We started talking about why. We're going to start talking about how. All of the really big venues your sports stadiums have in-house frequency coordinators. There are more and more freelance frequency coordinators beginning to offer their services on the open market. I'm doing it on about a monthly basis for events. And we have events now where I might coordinate 50 or 60 frequencies at a time, and I may have to generate that in a couple of days. So let's talk about some basic radio stuff. The reason that we have to coordinate frequencies, even when we have plenty of white space, is intermodulation distortion. It's abbreviated IMD or intermod. What happens when you have two powerful radio signals that are close to each other in the spectrum is that they create distortion products at even intervals away from the difference between them. The closer they are, the closer these products will be to the original carrier frequencies. This chart uses an example of two radios, one at 500 megahertz, one at 501 megahertz. That's pretty close together, but not unrealistic for two microphones to coexist at 1 megahertz intervals. But not too many of them, because what happens is we don't care much about the even order products because they're very far away from the target. If I'm working at 500, I really don't care what's happening at 1, 2, and 3, and 4 megahertz. I care very much what's happening at 499, 502. These odd-ordered products are very, very troublesome when we start to put a lot of microphones very close together in the spectrum. And then you add stuff like powerful DTV stations to your mix, and you are going to get a lot of these products. And the danger is that when they start to overlap, two of these thirds can add up to a distortion product that is almost the same amplitude as one of your carriers. Now, you get up to 16, 20, 30, 40 of these things all packed in, you get a lot of this stuff. And when I see it on a scan, I refer to it as fur, and it is very troublesome. So this is why we coordinate frequencies using powerful calculating software. When James first started doing this, he had massive spreadsheets that he used, formulas in spreadsheets to do this, and then he wrote the industry standard software, and that's what most of us are using right now who do this for a living. Now, there are things you can do with your system to minimize intermodulation distortion, physical things that you can do in your system that help. One of them, and you'll see this backstage at every Broadway show and at a lot of big meetings, put your transmitters in metal trays and separate them physically with something ferrous, because the time when you are at your worst as far as intermodulation goes is when you're backstage and all your transmitters are in a pile. All those antennas are right next to each other. And so if you can separate them, and even if you don't have the metal bread pans, one thing you can do is just get a bigger table and separate these things. And if you can take these handhelds and alternate their direction to just get those antennas far away from each other while you're doing your testing, that will help. And so what James is showing us here is that on his little scanner, he has these beautiful high carriers, and all of his distortion is way down in a nice flat noise floor. He gave me a slide that shows a before and after for using the bread trays. It's awesome. So before the bread trays, this is all intermod distortion from his own microphones. It's huge. It's massive. There's only 8 microphones in all of this garbage. He puts them in the bread trays, beautiful, flat noise floor. He's got like 40 or 50 dB of signal to noise here. That's fantastic. So if you've got a lot of these microphones, try the bread tray solution, or just try spreading them out while you're doing your setup and your wargaming, because you'll get a lot of less crap if you're doing your stuff on the fly and you haven't done a good calculation.
So I'm...
Chris.
I'm not as familiar with RF, but looking at this, so if you have two transmitting antennas close together, they'll kind of affect each other.
The closer those transmitters are physically, the higher the amplitude of their distortion products will be temporarily.
And so by putting them in the metal trays, you're kind of shielding them?
And the other thing that you can't see in this picture is that the antenna that's receiving those is way up high above them. So they all kind of have line of sight to the antenna, but not to each other. And that's how he got that beautiful product down there. It was it, it it's not an entirely realistic thing. If you remember in that Super Bowl slide, he had those great big helical antennas, and they were very high, but they were focused at where those transmitters were going to end up on the field. So another thing that you can do to improve your signal-to-noise in your indoor setups is get your receive antennas as close to the stage as possible. Don't just set up your whips at the rack 50, 100 feet away. Get those paddles in the wings. Get them right in the curtains. Get them in the orchestra pit. Get them close to those people. Because you'll cut down on a lot of extra crap getting into your system that way. So there are physical things you can do in the layout of your system to minimize this distortion, but it'll always be there at some level, and you have to calculate for it, you have to prepare for it. So how many people use the auto scanners in the receivers of their equipment? I know Dan does. You set up a wireless system, and you press the magic button, and it says, here's a good frequency for you, and you plug it in, and it works. There's some pros and cons to that. One of the big pros is it's fast and it works. The calculators that are built into those receivers work fairly well. They do a really fast wideband scan, and they're like, okay, here's some white space, here's some white space, here's some white space. Here's one you can use. Some of them will actually spit out a handful, and if they do, if you have any equipment that's going to do an auto scan and spit out a handful of frequencies, write them down. You may want to use them again. Or you may find out that the more units you add, some of those aren't good anymore, and then you can cross them off. But it's a good exercise to just write it down, see what works, and I'm going to show you a quick and easy method to see if some of them are better than others in a minute. But the right way to use the auto scanners isn't just to do it once, write down six, use all six, and go to town. That's not the right way. What you should do is turn all your transmitters off, do a scan, take the best frequency that comes out, sync one transmitter to it, and turn it on. Then go to the next unit, run the scan again with the one on. Get the best frequency, sync it, leave it on. Do this all the way down the line. And when you've done that, then go back to the beginning and one at a time turn them off and see how much noise you have at your receiver. If the only tools you have to work with are the auto scan button on your receiver and the RF meter on that receiver, then you go to a process that we call wargaming, and that's that you turn them off one at a time, and you see how much noise your own gear is putting back into each one of those channels with its transmitter off. And that's when you get into your bread tins, that's when you get into your antenna placements, and separating those antennas to try to minimize that noise. So if at that point, if you're not getting hits, if you're not getting a lock on each one as you turn it off, and there's only a bar or two of that noise, you're probably okay to go ahead. But it's a good exercise to do. It's a good habit to get into. And if it's the only tool you have, use it. The Dan.
And when you scan and it finds white spaces here, you're using the term white space to mean empty space rather than one of the so-called white space devices?
Correct. I mean empty space. I mean current empty space in your venue at that time. The con of using the auto scanners is that it doesn't tell you what else is in the environment today in your venue. You have to take its word for it. It may be a little too conservative. It may not be conservative enough for your environment on that day. You just have to trust it. The other thing that's bad about the auto scan is that it's only good for the minute that you push the button. If somebody fires up at the hotel next door, your auto scan's not good anymore. You got to do it again. And you don't know what you had, and you don't know what you're going to get. And that's why I'm constantly scanning. Whenever I have an event with more than four microphones, I am scanning my environment. I am looking for those bogeys, and I'm trying to figure out what they are. Sometimes I know what they are. Sometimes I know that there's a TV crew in that breakout room because they've come to me and asked for good frequencies, and I look to make sure that they're on them. So the con of the auto scan is it doesn't tell you what else is out there, and it's only good for a minute. So wargame your auto scans if that's the way you're going to roll. So find out what's in your environment. Take notes, track the changes. That'll keep you busy until the FCC gives us the bad news. So we're going to go to a break, and when we come back, I'm going to show you how I build a show with IAS. Thank you.